Welcome to Fed Central, brought to you by Deloitte, a program where executives and federal government leaders talk about the issues and initiatives that are making a real impact on the business of government today to help government help America. There's no denying that innovation will be critical to helping the federal government find new ways to increase efficiencies and improve mission outcomes. In these tight times, it's even more important. Today, we'll be discussing innovation as a top priority for growth and improving government. Joining us to talk about it today, Cesar Hidalgo, an assistant professor at the MIT Media Lab and faculty associate at Harvard University Center for International Development. Cesar's work focuses on improving the understanding of systems by using and developing concepts of complexity, evolution, and network science. And J.R. Reagan is the Federal Chief Innovation Officer and Principal at Deloitte & Touche LLP. He leads the Deloitte Center for Federal Innovation, a leading-edge demonstration, analytics, and technology development center very close to Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us today. Cesar, welcome. I know you're on the telephone today. Happy to have you.
Thank you, Jane. I'm happy to be here.
And J.R., I'll start with you. Let me ask you this question. What's the macro view of innovation trends, and how is it impacting governments around the world, and especially here in the United States?
Yeah, it's interesting. Innovation now, you know, people would define it differently. In some cases, you know, we think of innovation as invention, which isn't always the case. It's more about doing things differently than about doing different things. And what that really means is about breaking trade-offs that we're used to. We think about those costs, we think about the benefits, and we always think that we have to add more costs to get those benefits. Not always the case anymore. And one of those things that we're coming across now is this notion of big data, that we have so much data available to us, the data that we own, that we create inside of our agency. And all of that data, that unstructured data out there that citizens are creating and companies are creating, social media and things like that. So combining this gives us some really great new ways of doing what we did in the old way and doing it differently. Cesar, I know that you've been looking at some of these examples in your work. How are things different now with this notion of big data?
So that's a great question, and I think the best way of illustrating it is by using a specific example. So probably both you and Jane remember the Japanese earthquake that happened a little bit more than a year ago.
Sure.
And I remember I was in Japan on January, and I met a group of people from Dentsu. This is a large advertising company, and they showed me one project that they had done, you know, in collaboration with Honda, the car maker, after the earthquake. The project was called Connecting Lifelines and Lifelines, and actually was a project in which big data was used, you know, to assess which roads were operational after the earthquake. So the project actually was very simple. You know, you would see a large map of Japan, and, you know, the clock would be running, and as the clock would be running, you would see like these little dots that would start moving around and sort of like, you know, drawing traces. Each one of these dots actually was the GPS of one of the Honda cars. And that showed how they were able to use all of the data that was being collected automatically and seamlessly by people that were driving right after the earthquake to determine which roads were operational and which roads were not. Now, I found that to be an excellent example of how big data is changing the way that you can do things, because this is a task that in any case would need to be performed by a government and would be performed through a network that would be much more formal, much slower. And it would take probably, you know, a large effort just to assess which roads were operational or not. And here, these designers were showing in this very simple example how they were using big data to actually create, you know, a map that was much needed at the time.
So that would also involve geospatial intelligence, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah, it involves, and actually it involves a variety of things. You know, besides analytics, you can think that also involves the ability to actually collect that data and the rights to collect that data, you know. And this is, I think, where one of the big constraints of big data at the moment, that everyone is sort of like afraid about different, you know, angles of the privacy question. And data is being locked up or traded mostly in the black market. If you think about it, in this collaboration, this is what makes possible, because Dentsu is the advertising company of Onda, and they're already working together and they have a relationship.
Yeah, the job. Go ahead, Cesar.
Exactly. Yeah. So now My question would be, would the government of Japan or would the government of any country would have been possible to come up with a map as quickly as the one that the private sector did using the data that they had available? My intuition is that probably they would not have, because there would have been too many permissions that would have needed to be requested in order to create the map.
So in my recent past, I remember that the Geospatial Intelligence Agency did actually have to use mapping techniques in order to figure out where to go during Hurricane Katrina because the roads were all covered over. So governments do allow those things to happen.
Yeah, it's a great example where, you know, a lot of what used to be only the domain of government, now we have the ability outside of government to do some of those same things and even cheaper. And it's a good wake-up call for government to look around, look in its cupboard, so to speak, and say, what do we have now that we can combine with different things, especially for geospatial? Cesar talked about Japan. We see that a lot in crisis mapping all over, where we can actually take a lot of the visualization and apply that to lots of different problems. It could be food and product safety. It could be even things as mundane as where are folks going in terms of vacations and where we might need services for that. All this becomes a new way for us to look at this this data and combine it in different ways we didn't have the ability for.
So there are different explanations of what big data is. Yeah. Can you give us your view of what big data is, and then Cesar will ask you?
Yeah, for me, it's we used to think of it solely as the data that I own, and now big data is what we call digital exhaust. It's produced in all of the different things that we do. From buying gasoline at a pump produces data from a credit card transaction to the cell phone types of things. Everything is emanating this data. When you include that with the data that you own inside your four walls, now we get that definition of big data, and that's how I view it.
And so, Cesar, what does it mean to you, big data?
Yeah, so I've been dealing with a lot of people that have been thinking about big data, and one of the main confusions that I find is that people tend to confuse big data with lots of data. You know? So in order to make a distinction there, what I do is I say, well, you know, actually big data has to be three times big, not just one times big. And the three dimensions that I demand, you know, for big data are first to be big in size, and that's where kind of like the confusion comes from. You know, you need data not on hundreds or just thousands of individuals, but millions or tens of millions of individuals or different entities. Then it has to be big in resolution. If I just have, you know, information that, for example, is aggregated at, you know, at a yearly level or maybe a monthly level, I'm not going to be able to do a lot of things that I could do if I had data at a finer spatial resolution, temporal resolution, or typological resolution, meaning that I know, for example, which items a person purchased or what was the identity of the business in which they were at a certain time of the day. You know, and the third dimension is that actually it has to be big in scope. You know, there's a lot of data that is big, you know, in the sense that is big in size, is big in resolution, but it's only applicable to a very particular industry or to a very particular problem, so it's not big in scope. Like the data that is big in scope actually allows you to explore opportunities that maybe you didn't thought of at the time that the data was being collected. And for me, when data is big in the three dimensions, size, resolution, and scope, is when we're really talking about big data and not about lots of data.
So how do governments utilize, to their advantage, even cost-effectively, big data? I mean, what is it that governments around the world, especially here in the U.S., JR, can do?
Well, one of the things we can start to look at is human behavior differently. You know, it used to be that we had to ask citizens questions, get that response, and we'd kind of deal with that kind of a rote process. Now, without having to ask the questions, we can get a lot of answers because they're out there telling us already on Facebook, on Twitter, on these different social platforms, as well as what is happening in industries. The data sets are much greater now. So now it becomes more a matter of what we'd say hypotheses, not requirements. Not to say, here's the answer, build this for me, but to ask a question and say, how can we answer this and what do we what is available to us? So we can actually start looking at the types of energy we might need and where that is, where we might need to locate agencies in a building and carbon footprints. Food safety, you know, all these different types of things. Now we can be a little bit more forward-looking and maybe preemptive and predictive in some ways than maybe before.
And how do governments put their toe in the water? Innovation is a major driver of change. The concern might be that there are costs associated with innovating. So where can they go, or how can they develop for themselves a roadmap for effectiveness?
One of the things that we've done in Roslyn with our Center for Federal Innovation is actually being able to have that safe place for co-creation. We like for our clients to come in and ask those hypotheses, and we can surround them with what we call a hive, a highly immersive visual environment, where they can start putting these unlike things together in a very visual way and start to get some insights from that. We oftentimes talk about BYOD. It's been described in a lot of the press as bring your own device. We would say bring your own data. Bring some small amount in, begin to work on that and visualize it in different ways. Enormous insights come from that co-creation type of space.
And so is there anything like that, Hidalgo, that goes on in the global sector, in the private sector, where people, how do they manage to get started on the path to, you know, aggregating big data or utilizing it effectively?
Well, I would say that as is now, there's very little of that going on. I think there's more talk than action. I do see it quite a bit because I do interact with people that have data. And there are many reasons why that is the case. A lot of the data that now exists was not collected thinking about building a business on big data. It was collected for operational purposes. So mobile phone companies were collecting data, you know, to be able to charge bills and to be able, you know, to see if the network was operating reliably, to be able to strategize on the plans that they would sell. And credit card companies also, you know, they were keeping track of the expenses and keeping track of the accounts, not necessarily thinking that there was going to be a future in which that data was going to be, you know, the most valuable thing. Also, thinking about expanding into new sectors, because you can always think of the internal purposes of the data, such as, for instance, trying to predict future credit defaults and whatnot. So what happened is that actually the data in many cases I've seen it is quite siloed and it's very hardly accessible even for people inside the organizations. You know, and now a little bit of all of the hype that is going around big data is helping destroy political barriers inside organizations or between organizations such that these collaborations can be shared, because the data is being handled by groups that are very different than the ones that would be the creatives that will be creating future applications. So what I would say that it's at the center of all of the discussion that we hear around in the newspapers about big data is a little bit of that internal political struggle that is happening within many large organizations. So I wouldn't say that we're at the point in which we have seen the benefits of big data yet.
Very interesting, and we'll continue with that when we return. We're talking this morning to Cesar Hidalgo, assistant professor at the MIT Media Lab and faculty associate at Harvard University Center for International Development, and J.R. Reagan, federal chief innovation officer and principal at Deloitte & Touche and the leader of the Deloitte Center for Federal Innovation. We'll be back with more about innovation in just a moment. You're listening to Fed Central on Federal News Radio 1500. AM. I'm Jane Norris.
Federal agencies call on Deloitte for insights, people, and the experience it brings to their most meaningful and challenging problems. Drawing from its broad portfolio of capabilities, global resources, and leading practices across government, Deloitte's federal experience helps clients achieve more today while building a stronger foundation for tomorrow. Learn more at www.deloitte.com/federal. Deloitte, helping government help America.
Welcome back to Fed Central, brought to you by Deloitte. We're talking today about innovation and the way that government can grow and improve through innovation. J.R. Reagan is our guest, Federal Chief Innovation Officer and Principal at Deloitte & Touche, LLP, and Cesar Hidalgo, an Assistant Professor at the MIT Media Lab and Faculty Associate at Harvard University Center for International Development. So we were talking about innovation and how it can be, inculcated, I guess, in places like the federal government. So let me ask this question. Is the federal government a good place for innovation to take root? Is that environment even conducive to innovation?
You know, I'm of the thought that and you know, innovation can happen everywhere. Sometimes we just don't see it. And it happens in government all over the place. We certainly are very familiar with DARPA and IARPA and these places that have an innovation the mission to them. But even outside of that, in the agencies that may not be thought of as innovative, they're doing really great things every day. They happen to get lost in the back room. We see it with our clients all the time that, you know, frankly, that tomorrow actually produces a better outcome than we started in the programs that they're at. But frankly, they don't get replicated very often. That's the problem. So, you know, we spend more money on sometimes the same problems in other agencies that if we just had learned from the previous one and replicated some of that success, it allows sort of that zigzag effect that always produces great innovations. It's almost never in a straight line. And that allows for more of the culture of innovation to grow when we can replicate successful smaller innovations.
Cesar, what do you say?
Yeah, I agree with JR. I do think that innovation occurs all over the place, you know, occurs in the public and the private sector. But one of the big problems is not for innovation only to occur, but also to spread. So there could be people that actually you find that have great ideas, but it's very hard for them to get any traction to scale those ideas up, to implement those ideas up. And I think that's a little bit of the main problem. If you look at a design lab, at a, you know, innovation lab outside of the government setting, in a setting that I would be more used to, like, for example, here at the MIT Media Lab, which is a very creative place. One important thing for innovation is freedom, is the feeling that you are entitled to have a bad idea, pursue it, and then eventually, you know, get inspired by that idea that maybe didn't go anywhere to create something else, you know? So there is kind of like this environment that is very, very forgiving of taking risks, you know, and actually very welcoming of those risks. There's an environment in which, you know, people understand that, you know, and they have the freedom to explore. I think that in more structured settings, I found it that it's a little bit harder, you know, to do that because ideas are required to be accountable from very early on, you know. And usually when you're making ideas accountable or you want an idea to sound good very early on, the only thing that you're going to be doing is you're going to be exploring just the coast of what you know. But you're never going to have a very disruptive innovation. Never you're going to like rethink the whole way that you're approaching, you know, the problem. So
right.
That's, I think, one of the big differences.
So does government have to then follow the lead of the private sector, JR, in order to innovate?
I think that there's a lot of lessons learned from the private sector. You know, we have great, you know, private sector is incented to take risks. And so they're often able to try new business models a lot. And it's sort of the opposite side in government. It doesn't prevent government, though, from taking advantage and learning a lot from the private sector. Certainly, you know, the notion of design thinking now is very popular and is actually producing a lot of great results in the private sector. That's the notion that the user and the user experience drives a lot of that innovation. We're starting to see that now being adopted a little bit in government. And I think the more we can get towards how does the citizens, for example, participate in government, that citizen participation, I think that's fantastic in terms of driving innovation forward.
And has that been a success story in terms of user engagement, citizen participation? Are, you know, is the public at large taking advantage of the innovation much more readily than, say, larger entities like the federal government? Cesar, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think that actually the people have started to participate a little bit. The way that people have participated until now has been by using social media that actually was not designed originally for participation. Actually, Twitter was not even designed for people in the beginning. You know, and then it evolved into being a very popular tool among people, you know, but it was actually designed to communicate between devices. You know, And what has happened with that, you know, with all the use of Twitter and Facebook and, you know, the comments on the newspapers, you know, is that people have sort of created a culture in which it's okay to write down your opinion about a political issue, share it with others, discuss, you know, with the other strangers that are posting somewhere in this media, the ideas and share your views. You know, but if you think about it, all of that basically doesn't add up too much because – the media that we're using to have those discussions does not help aggregate that into any form of action. So what we have is actually a lot of conversations going on, but then a new issue comes along, there's another conversation that happens, but these things don't add up into any concrete form of action. So what I do think that is going to start happening in the future is that you're going to start seeing media that is going to be designed for participation. And you're going to start seeing that there are going to be some, you know, state governments or local governments, maybe here in the U.S., maybe elsewhere, that are going to get into the forefront of this idea of having direct forms of participation through online technologies. And you're going to see that grow from very simple decisions and very simple issues, you know, into larger issues as time goes by. But I see that there is an important future and there's going to be more direct forms of participation simply because the technology is allowing them and they become, you know, obvious and natural ways of progression. Not because the decisions are necessarily going to be better. Sometimes technology advances because it's natural, not necessarily because, you know, it's an improvement.
It's certainly utilized. I mean, there's no doubt that people are engaging, even the federal government. You know, they are encouraging that kind of citizen participation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when you look at the other things that are out there now, like gamification, you know, how can we use principles such as badges and points and things like that to draw citizens into the things that maybe only government used to do, and actually to change behavior a little bit. There's a great example of how just being able to post points of citizens and how they're adapting to driving patterns and are they staying off the roads and HOV stuff like that. You know, can we incent them to be able to see through leaderboards and these things that maybe they can be a part of the solution in some of these larger problems? And it's starting to work a little bit. Things like gamification really play into that.
Gamification is something that's probably a new word for a lot of people, especially for federal government leaders. Do you want to explain it a little bit?
Yeah, it's really that principle then that if we make things more of a game that allows you to participate more, human behaviors, human beings love that kind of a scenario and gathering points and badges and being able to have a little bit of a draw into that. Often produces some pretty incredible behavior change, and we've seen that play out in the research literature, and we've seen that play out in real life. And things, you know, all you have to do is look at things such as Farmville on Facebook and things to see how people really aggregate to games, and we're seeing that that kind of mechanics being applied to how we can even create legislation.
Boy, never thought games would play a part in my development, but here we go. So, all right, let's talk about what really is on the minds of probably many in the federal government, probably those in the private sector as well, and that's budget pressures. So talk for a minute about how budgets can impact innovation. Is it a, you know, a non-starter? I mean, is budget always the biggest factor when deciding whether or not an innovative quality or technique can really be effective for your agency or for your company?
Well, I think we're all coming to the realization that the budgets will be less. And in some cases, we have to do more with less. In some cases, we have to do less with less. Regardless, I think we don't have to give up. You know, there's things now, such as we talked about big data and even visualization, that allows me to see where things are working better and where we need to focus. And so being able to be innovative around even things such as budget and allowing me to focus and have a little bit of more of a laser approach to issues will allow us to be a lot more innovative around things that had been more mundane in the past. So we can see that.
Cesar, we have about a minute left. What's your view about budget pressures?
Yeah, so I do agree that obviously budgets are constraining, and they're constraining two things, in the total amount, but also, you know, in the line items. And when it comes to innovation, freedom is extremely important. So when we're doing innovation, one question that I would ask, you know, is when there is a budget that is being allocated for a certain project, how much of the time of the people that is participating in that project is going to report back or to ask permissions, or to actually do administrative work related to the project? Maybe if the budgets become smaller, but at the same time, you know, there is more freedom to do things inside them, it could be that the pressure, you know, is not going to be as big as it would be in a world in which budgets become smaller and accountability increases, because I do see that there's a lot of time that is going into the accountability of projects rather than the realization of them.
Excellent point, and thank you both for joining us today. The show has flown by, but an interesting topic, and you can find more at federalnewsradio.com. We'll put all the information about the Innovation Lab and the Center for Deloitte's Center for Federal Innovation there as well. So thanks for joining us today. Cesar Hidalgo, Assistant Professor at the MIT Media Lab, and J.R. Reagan, Federal Chief Innovation Officer and Principal at Deloitte & Touche LLP. Thank you all for listening. This is Fed Central on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jane Norris.
This has been Fed Central on Federal News Radio 1500 AM with Jane Norris, your host. Make sure to tune in again in 2 weeks for another edition of Fed Central on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and on federalnewsradio.com/FedCentral.